Turn with me to Judges chapter 13. By the way, be praying for Pastor Tyler and Stephanie and the kids. They're enjoying some well-earned vacation time these weeks, and I'm not quite sure where they are. That's probably good. We probably shouldn't know where they are because we even pester them. But just if they come to mind, be praying for them. They've had a busy season of ministry, and for those of you who have kids in our youth ministry, you know it's been just a wonderful season as well. And so we just trust that they're having a great time away. We're coming to our second lap through the story of Samson. We were in the park last week, if you were with us. We walked through this story really with an aim to see how Samson struggled with the calling of God in his life. Because surely if there is one thing we are meant to see in this story, that is a part of it. God had a specific calling, very, very detailed calling that involved a specific vow that Samson's parents made on his behalf, involving some specific things he was to do and not do. And basically, if you look through the rest of his life, you will see him doing everything he can to break that vow, to somehow free himself of the calling of God, and only to learn that it was an inescapable calling. And I hope that if you walked away with nothing else last week, it would be just that profound sense that God has called me, He's good and He loves me, and I ought not to run. I just ought to surrender to Him, trust Him, and align my life with His calling on my life. But we're not done with Samson's story yet, because there's some other things we need to see. In fact, we're not done this week, we're going to do one more lap next week. So we've got three full laps. And the reason I didn't break it into like chapter 13 1 week and 14 the next is I think we see better the pieces of his story when we look at the whole thing from chapter 13 to 16 of Judges. So that's kind of why we're doing it this way. So here's the plan this morning. The plan this morning is kind of to reverse engineer his life. So you know what that means. I know for those of you who have kids or grandkids or you've been around kids, you will know what it means to reverse engineer something. It's when you take something that was working perfectly fine and you put a screwdriver into the hand of some six-year-old and they take it all apart. Or maybe they were 10 and they thought they could get it back together. They were sure they knew how the pieces fit, but by the time they're set, or if you come over to my garage, you will see this happening. It doesn't stop. 44, still taking us, you know, take apart stuff. It's like, I thought I could get it back together. Right? But you do it because you think you can improve it or learn something. That's what we're going to do with Samson's life. We're going to kind of pull it apart because there's some things that we need to learn. Another way maybe to look at this is kind of maybe more my bent, is sort of like the crash test sort of dummy sort of scenario where you take a perfectly good car, for those of us who love cars, this is painful, and you crash it into a wall. Right? Why do they do that? It's not for entertainment. It's not because they're trying to just ruin perfectly good cars and cost themselves money. It's with the confidence that if we did that and studied it, there'd be something we would walk away from learning. We could do better in the future, right? That's why they do that kind of thing. We want to do that with Samson because really the whole story of Judges is just essentially one large crash test over and over. The tragedy of the story is that no one seems to be learning anything. It doesn't get better. It's not like every generation sort of successfully sort of gets it a little bit better than the one before, and by the end they figured it all out. It's going the opposite direction. They seem to be kind of sliding further and further into a dark hole. But hopefully as we look at this, we don't make those same mistakes. Hopefully as we look at it, we can step back and say, yes, Samson did some foolish things. But maybe if we looked and considered those things, we could avoid some of the mistakes he made. That's our hope. So that's what we're going to do this morning, looking specifically at the issue of how he dealt with temptation and sin. In fact, if you want a sort of a title, I'm not big on titles, but if you wanted a title, you could call this like Judges Part 18, or something a little more exciting, How to Give In to Temptation. Which I know sounds like a funny title because we already know how to do that, but the goal is looking at what happens in Samson's life so that we don't repeat his mistakes. There's where we're going this morning. Now, just sort of the refresher, so we're all on the same page. Judges ends with a verse that goes something like that. Like this. In chapter 21, I think it's verse 25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. That's sort of the summary statement of the whole book that describes chapter 1, verse 1, to the end of the book. A day where there was no king, even though there was, and his name was the Lord, And everyone did what was right. They acted upon what they thought was right in their own eyes. Here's the problem. When we come to places like chapter 13, verse 1, we read a statement like this. The people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Right? And so there's what they thought was right in their sight, and then there was what God said was right in His sight, and the two things were not the same thing. And so the people were doing one thing that was in direct violation and conflict with what God wanted for them. And He wasn't trying to rob them of joy. It wasn't like God was there saying, I wonder what I can do to make life miserable for my people. No, he was saying, this way of living is going to bring maximum hope, maximum joy, because you're going to be able to live in a relationship with me. And the people kept trading that for something else. And as a result, we come on statements like this, the last half of verse 1 of chapter 13. So the Lord gave them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. Now that little statement, let's just kind of dwell on that for just a minute. That's the longest time in the whole book God will give Israel over to the enemies. So we've got a plot line that goes something like this, over and over. We're on our seventh time through this. It goes something along these lines. The nation of Israel took their eyes off the Lord. They chose sin, an idol, something other than God to trust and hope in and treasure. As a result, God hands them over to their enemies to discipline them. And so they go through a time of oppression and testing. Eventually they cry out to the Lord, because that's what we do when things get hard. We remember Him. They cry out. God sends a deliverer called a judge. That's the term. That's why the book's called Judges. These men and women that God raised up to save His people. The judge comes, brings freedom and deliverance, and as long as the judge is alive, there's salvation. There's often it's called rest. The people of Israel are at rest. And then the judge dies, the people forget the Lord, and we repeat. And we've been through this now seven long times. But every time we've done it, gone through the cycle, parts of it start to go missing. I hope you've seen that. That's the point of Judges. It's showing us sort of the slow decline of a nation. By the time we get to Samson, you'll notice there's going to be no deliverance. It's like, well, when do we get to the good part? When does he get rid of the Philistines? He doesn't. But probably even more troubling, and I think very intentional, is there's no cry out to the Lord. There's not going to be a moment where the people, under the weight of the oppression, say, Lord, please come and save us from the Philistines. So what is going on? Here's the situation at that point. We're talking 3,300 years or so ago. The Philistines had arrived on the scene, a migratory people who had come with a specific aim to this part of the world. We actually don't know historically exactly where they come from, but they arrive on the coast of what we would call modern-day Israel, all their armies all ready to go and invade Egypt. And that's what they did. They launched a massive campaign against Egypt, intending that that would be their new home. The only problem is they failed. They weren't able to take it. They lost a massive battle. They retreated back to Israel and decided, we can't go back home. We'll just live here. This sets up about the next 200 or 300 years of difficulty for Israel, because the Philistines will now occupy the same land that the Israelites are trying to occupy. And so the Philistines keep coming up, right? Even by the time David comes on the scene. Remember David, Goliath, the Philistines, right? Same people. Nothing's changed over all those years. Now this enemy in particular has some strange components to it that are different, say, from previous judges, the Midianites and the Moabites, because those stories typically go like this. The Midianites came with their army, and Israel gathered their army, and they had a battle, and God was really good, and He did something miraculous, and so Israel shouldn't have won, but they did win, so that everyone knew that this was the Lord who had saved His people. That's kind of how the stories go. This time, we're not going to read of a battle. We don't read of armies. It's like huge parts of what we would expect are just not there. You want to know why? Because the Israelites were actually relatively pleased with the situation. That's the tragic, stunning reality of the situation. Rather than being the distinct people of God for His purpose, because that was their calling. That was the whole design. God said, I'm going to give you a land. I'm going to be your God. Here's the relationship with a purpose. And the purpose is that I'm going to bless you and care for you so that when other nations look at you, they're going to look and say, I wonder why Israel's different. Why do you look the way you do? And you're going to be able to say, we are different and we look the way we look because of the Lord. And wouldn't you want to look like us? And all the nations would say, yes, we do. That was how it was supposed to be. Instead, at this point in history, you find the Israelites intermarrying, they're trading. The Philistines, by the way, they had invented or developed how to work with iron, so they had tools and weapons the Israelites didn't have. The Israelites couldn't get these any other place. I said the early service, it's kind of like Urban Star jeans and Costco. It's like, I wouldn't need a Costco membership, except where else would I get my jeans? Right? That's the situation for the Israelites. Where else would we get iron tools? And we'll trade the God of Scripture for a shovel. That's what they did. We would rather have a rake made of iron or a pick than walk with the Lord. In the middle of all that, no crying, because they're not a... They like it. God sends one man to begin deliverance. His name will be Samson. Now we're told a few things about his life in chapter 13. Or actually, interesting enough, we're told two specific things about his life. One is he will begin the deliverance, but he won't complete it. He's not going to actually get rid of the Philistines right from the beginning. We know this. So we shouldn't be surprised by the end, but still sort of in our hearts, I hope we're a little surprised, a little shocked, a little disappointed. That, we're told, the other part is that his parents will make over his life something called a Nazirite vow. Now, if you were to go to number 6, you'll see the detailed instructions on what this meant. But it essentially means that you were to have nothing to do with vines, like the grapevines or products that come from grapevines. You would have nothing to do with a dead body of any variety. And you were not to cut your hair. Now, I actually was sort of curious. I try to picture these things. You probably do that too, right? I wonder what Samson looked like. I gave you my theory last week. I think he was probably scrawny looking. I don't think he looked like Arnold Schwarzenegger in his prime. Because you remember when the Philistines are trying to figure out, why is he so strong? They keep wanting to know what's the secret. Right? If he was like that big, there's no secret. It's like, well, it's obvious. He's just huge. But they want to know the secrets. I'm kind of picturing a scrawny guy, kind of, well, maybe like me, with really long hair. So I actually went online and figured this out. 3 to 5 feet. That's about how long hair apparently can grow before it starts falling out. You lose 50 to 100 hairs a day. Some of us are really good at this. So, right? You and me, Barry, we're advanced. Right? The rest of you are not so good at doing it. Right? So eventually it falls out, but his hair would have been long. We find out later on in the story he's got it in 7 braids. So you're kind of getting a bit now of a picture of this man. But he was like this from the time he was a little boy. Some of us remember that. Who among us as little kids wanted to stand out? Anyone? Anyone want to just be the odd one out among your group of friends? The answer is no. We do crazy, foolish things to not stand out. Starting to get a sense of Samson's life? No wonder he was willing to trade everything just to be like everyone else. His words, I'd be like every other man, he'll tell Delilah. So from a young age, he's not like everyone else. He's got a purpose just like Israel has a purpose. He's got a calling just like Israel had a calling. Interestingly enough, you remember Israel doesn't cry out to the Lord? His parents, who were told almost painfully are barren, also don't cry out to the Lord. Do you know they're the only ones in Scripture who are barren, who God miraculously works through and announces with an angel that you're going to have a miraculous birth even though you're barren? They're the only ones who don't cry out to the Lord. The whole thing is set up that we would look and say, here's the nation of Israel and here's Samson. And they are on parallel tracks. You read Samson's story, you're reading Israel's story. And we're talking about it because we don't want it to be our story. See, God's called us. We have a purpose. Spirit's within us. We don't want to find ourselves doing the things that Samson's doing. Now, we'll move a little bit quicker through the story because last week we kind of walked through a little bit slowly. By the time we really pick up Samson, it's in chapter 14. The first episode of his life, of his adult life, is him going to Timnah, which is a Philistine border town. So he's crossed over the border, and we might expect, knowing the background of what Samson's supposed to do to stand up against Philistine oppression, that this will be the moment he will raise an army, and he will bring people with him, and they will go to battle. Instead, we discover he's gone there because he's looking for a woman. We're never told her name. In fact, the whole thing is incredibly demeaning to women. In fact, that's part of the downward spiral of Judges. If you're looking for kind of the brokenness evidence of it, that's one of the aspects. The treatment of women just gets worse and worse and worse the further we go into the story. And sadly, we're not done yet. The next few chapters, it gets even worse than this. But through this story, you're just going to see some pretty brutal things happening. He goes, and here's the critical phrase in chapter 14. He sees, and he wants, and he takes. Why? Literally, because he decides something's right in his own eyes. She is right in my eyes. Now, there's a few back and forth trips. Samson keeps going to Timnah, coming home, as he tries to sort of arrange this marriage, work things out with his parents. It's eventually decided, he basically informs his parents that she will be his wife. They reach some sort of agreement. We pick back up in the story with a strange little scene where Samson begins to make a wager with the Philistines. A wager about a riddle that they won't be able to solve, and if we had time, and we're kind of going back to last week, we would walk through that. But we would see as a result of the wager, Samson does something brutal. He murders 30 men to be able to fulfill the payment of this wager. And that begins a back and forth series of brutal incidents. He kills and they kill, and he burns crops and so they burn his wife. And I mean, it just, the sin and brokenness of chapter 14 is just heartbreaking. It's disturbing. This is the part that doesn't show up in the kid's story, I guarantee you. Right? But when we read it, I hope you are actually troubled by what you're reading. I think that's supposed to happen to us. We're not supposed to read through this going, well, this is kind of a nice story. This is entertaining. We're supposed to read through this saying, something is devastatingly wrong with this. And then we're supposed to be able to figure it out. So there's kind of what's happening through chapter 14. Chapter 15 kind of continues that sort of plot line, the back and forth, the fighting and killing, on and on it goes, till we get to the end of chapter 15 and we come across a very odd scene. It's not entirely unexpected. Samson takes the job, a fresh jawbone. Why? Well, because he's touching a corpse. And through his whole life, he just keeps doing, remember the vows? Nothing from a vine, nothing dead, don't cut your hair. The first story, he ends up in a vineyard. That's where he finds a lion that he kills with his bare hands. Anyone see a problem with that? It's like, if you were looking for a way to break the vow, that's where you go and that's what you do. Samson just seems to say, I don't care what the Lord has called me to. I want nothing to do with it. We find him here again with the jawbone, having killed 1,000 men, and he is dying of thirst. So he says to the Lord, all of a sudden he brings the Lord back in for this one brief moment. He won't call the place of the Lord. He won't recognize the hand of the Lord. In fact, he sings a song in chapter 15, and it doesn't even mention the Lord. It's just like a song he sings to himself. The song about me using a jawbone to kill men. That's his song. And then, an odd moment, where he cries out to the Lord and says, Lord, you have granted this great salvation by the hand of your servant, and now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised. All of a sudden, in verse 18, he remembers the covenant and the agreements. It's like, Samson, but where was that all along? Because up to now, it hasn't even mattered in your life. Now, if you were to think of that scene, just kind of picture it. Here's a man dying of thirst, and then God in verse 19 does something in response. He splits open the ground and out comes water. Does it remind you of any other moments in Scripture? It should. It should remind you of a couple moments earlier in the Old Testament when the Israelites were in Exodus, coming through the wilderness, calling out to God. It's like, God, you brought us out in the wilderness. Did you do this just to kill us? Because we're dying of thirst. And how does God answer? He splits a rock and provides water. You see what Judges is doing? It's helping us understand that Samson's story is the story of Israel. It's like a microcosm. His life is the life of that whole nation. Crying out to God when it's convenient, forgetting when it's not. Verse 16 is that critical story, the story of Samson and Delilah. A story that should have ended something like this. Samson fell in love with a woman who he shouldn't have fallen in love with, but he did anyway. But one day he goes to her and she asks him for the secret of his strength. And he says, you know what, I love you, and so I'll tell you. If you were to tie me up with 7 fresh sinews, again, it's part of a corpse that he's not supposed to. If you were to tie me up with 7 fresh sinews, I'd lose my strength. And so she does that when he falls asleep, ties him up, and then yells out, the Philistines are on you. He breaks the cord and they can't catch him. That's the moment, right, where the story should end. Please, right, where he goes, oh, wow. What a fool I've been. I've been blinded by the love, the infatuation, the lust I've had for this woman, but now I've seen She doesn't love me. She wants to destroy me. So I will go back home and return to the Lord. Wouldn't that be a great ending? And do the things he had fully intended for me to do. Instead, it's that story to the next time she asks him and he tells her the next time. Finally to this moment where he says, all right, I'll tell you. If you were to shave my head, my hair was to be cut, the vow would be over. He understands it. That's the troubling part. We had hoped, maybe some of us who are following along the story, maybe he just didn't know. Maybe his parents didn't fully instruct him in what the vow meant and what his responsibility. No, he fully knows. He tells her, explains the whole thing in agonizing detail. His hair is cut, his strength is gone. The last scene of his life, he's taken as a prisoner, eyes gouged out. He can no longer see. That's done. Put between two pillars in a Philistine temple. Cries out to God. And even in his death, he leaves us wishing for more. God, give me strength just one more time. Actually, it's more like, God, give me strength this once. Isn't that funny? It's like as though somehow God hadn't done it before, that was him. Just give me strength this once, that I may avenge your name, your glory, something. No, my eyes. Let me just die with the Philistines. Let me expand what he's saying there, what I think is the most natural way to read that. Let me die with the Philistines like a Philistine among the Philistines, because this is actually where I feel at home. After all they've done, let me just die here like them. Now there's our story. I hope I've destroyed the storybook version of that. You know, the precious moments, Samson and Delilah, that kind of thing. I mean, you never look at this story the same way. What do we do with it when we take it apart? Here's what I want to show you this morning. I want you to see just one idea. And here's how I want to explain it. When the gap between the impulse and the action shrinks, you know what I mean? Like when you want to do something, there's this temptation before you. No, you shouldn't. It's not the right thing to do or to think or to say. When the gap between that moment and the action that follows it shrinks, the gap between what God wanted for you and what will happen grows. That's how it works. The more that gap shrinks in Samson's life, the further away what could have been becomes. And I think the same thing is true of our lives. When we instantly act on our impulses, what could have been vanishes. And so here's the take home. I'll give it to you really, really plainly. Grow the gap. Now let me explain this a little bit. I don't mean grow the gap in the sense that, you know, temptation comes and I want to say this thing, but I'll bite my tongue for an hour and then I'll say it. I mean, grow the gap. Temptation, the impulse, build in some time here. Because what I think will happen is as we build in time and are able to think about this temptation, we'll be able to actually understand what's going on. We'll be able to actually analyze it and think it through and see it for the lie that it is. See, when we act instantly on the impulses, we don't realize the lie that's there in front of us. Because all sin's a lie. It's a pleasure, but it's fleeting. Even Scripture concedes that point. Sin is a fleeting pleasure. I mean, it is a pleasure. That's why temptation is tempting. If it wasn't, it wouldn't be tempting. But it's fleeting. In other words, you do, you say, you think, you act on the thing. You get sort of the instantaneous pleasure. And then all of a sudden, it vanishes. And you're left sitting there saying, hold on a second. I'm not any better. I'm worse off. But it's too late. I've done. I've said it. And all of a sudden, the consequences are all that's left. Because all sin does is rob. It's all it does. It doesn't add anything. It just takes. Now, all through Scripture, we have a long track record of God's people being a people of waiting. Ever notice that? I mean, you notice that. If you're following Jesus, you've noticed that. You've prayed, you've recognized that what Isaiah 64:4 tells us plainly, that God is a God who acts on behalf of those who wait, is inherently what his nature is. He acts when we wait. It's what makes him different than all other gods. See, all other gods are instant gratification gods. Right? That's why they were tempted to follow other gods. We do our thing and God makes it rain tomorrow. We do our thing, and God answers my prayer in 15 minutes. Okay, that's the temptation of what the other gods offer, but they can never follow through. God acts for those who wait, which is why we get these long, long passages over and over again that describe Christian character, what it means to be people who follow Jesus, and it often brings the idea of patience and waiting. I'm just flipping through my notes so I can find some of these passages. Let me read just a couple for you. Go something like this. Luke 8, verse 15. This is one of the classics. Jesus talking about soils. You know how he often did that? Using soils to kind of describe people in response to truth. Here's what he says in verse 15. As for the good soil. So this is the good one, right? As for the good soil, they are those who, hearing the word, hold it fast in an honest and good heart and bear fruit. Probably nothing surprising there, right? What's a good soil? They grab hold of the word and they hold it fast and they bear fruit. My problem is the verse isn't finished. There's two more words. They bear fruit with patience. It's not just bearing fruit, it's fruit with patience. God's people are a fruit-bearing people with patience. Paul, when he starts talking about his authority as an apostle, right? So we know there's certain things that set the apostles off of qualifications, and here's what he describes in verse 12 of 2 Corinthians 12. The signs of a true apostle were performed among you with utmost patience, with signs and mighty wondrous works. Right, so there's the mighty, wondrous, miraculous works. But did you catch the little part that he adds in the middle? With patience. To be an apostle means being someone with patience. Colossians 10, 1 to 12. Walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing to him, bearing fruit in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God, being strengthened with all power according to his glorious might. For, we're about to hear, why does God empower his people with his glorious might? What on earth would be his purpose to do that? He takes all his might, his glorious might, and then he uses it on your behalf to do something. You ready for this? Because you got an answer. It's like, think of an answer in your head. Here it is. For all endurance and patience. All the might of God used so that we would be a people of endurance and patience. Because I think something happens when we open up that gap. I think that's the moment where we resist the devil and he flees. That's the moment where we are slow to speak and something good happens as a result. That's the moment where we can capture thoughts and take them prisoner rather than acting on them. You see, because I think we all know stories of people who didn't do that. In fact, we are the story. And aren't your worst moments in life the moments where there was an impulse and you acted? And then you looked back a day later, an hour later, a week later, and you thought, why would I have been so foolish? Let me tell you why. Here's why you were so foolish. Here's why I'm so foolish in those moments. Because the impulse, the temptation looked really good. It offered a variety of hope. And we looked and thought, if I do think, say, act in that way, something good will happen. And it did for this long. And then it vanished. And now we're left with the crumbled results of that. I told the story in the first service of one of the a tragic story. I was going to say one of the more, I don't know, I can't even rate these things anymore. Seen, lived, watched, heard, too many, just like you. One of the stories I heard was of a pastor. Just like me. Back in the day, we used to collect offering in kids' church in the little church banks. I don't know if any of you ever were of that vintage. I raised in church, basically. We didn't almost need a house. Could have just lived in the church. But there was these little banks, and they were on the tables in a church room, like in the Sunday school rooms, and kids would bring their offering and put them in the little church, and then they would gather the offerings up and send them off to a missionary. That's how kind of what they did in kids' church. And this pastor decided, you know, after church on Sunday, I could just go through and I could empty those piggy banks into my pocket. It'd be my coffee money. He lost everything. Rightly so, because what a foolish thing to do. But I don't think the first day he went and he opened up the piggy bank, he thought, you know what? Today's the day. I think I want to lose everything. This is going to be great. At $1.50, I can have a coffee. And then everything will vanish. But it's worth it, because this is going to be a great coffee. Now, is coffee good? Did the coffee taste good? Probably. if you like coffee. If you don't, your answer is different, right? He took the $1.50 out of the little church piggy bank. He went and he drank a coffee. Did the coffee taste good? Yes. What happened 15 minutes later? What happened 5 months later, however long this game went on? There were moments of pleasure. And then it was all gone. Because that's what sin always does. Right? And some of you right now are stuck in that. You see, we are incredibly efficient people. This terrifies me to death. Right? We're efficient. We're really good, right? So if you know this, right? If you've ever had an argument with someone, a reoccurring one. Have you ever had one of these? Maybe someone that you work with. And day one, it takes you like an hour to get through it. Like it takes you slowly, things start to slowly heat up. And by the end, you're either into the yelling or the silent or whatever route you go, right? It takes a while. If you have the same argument or issue over and over again, you get to the end faster and faster and faster. It's how we work. Right? So 3 months later, if you're still having the same issue, you don't need an hour to get to the side. You walk in the door, you see the person, you go there right now. We do the same thing with sin. The first time we're going to step over the line, we wrestle, we weigh, and then we jump in. And then it just gets easier and easier, and the gap shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. And what I would beg of you is, grow the gap. Grow the gap so that you can actually look and say, you know what? If I do act in that way, will it really bring me hope? What will happen tomorrow or next week if I keep doing that thing? It doesn't add, it's going to rob. There's a man by the name of John Bloom. He talks about this very thing. He uses a term called the mirage moment. We'll end with this. He talks about this idea that when someone, you've seen the movies, right, and someone goes out into the wilderness, I've never actually seen this in real life, they go into the desert, and then they think they see water, this oasis thing, a mirage, but it's not really there, and they know it's not really there, right, they've been there before, they've seen this place, they know there's no water in the middle of the desert, right, but something in their eyes tells them there is. It's a false hope. It's not actually going to satisfy because there's nothing actually there. He talks about this very same thing in the context of sin. We have a mirage moment where we look and we say, if I do, say, act, think, oh wow, it's going to satisfy. But it's not really there. It's nothing real. There's no substance. He says in Genesis chapter 3, we have our first mirage moment. Adam and Eve know full well what God says about that particular tree. You know the tree I mean? The one thing they weren't supposed to eat from. They know the consequence. And then Satan comes along. Listen to what he says to them. You will not surely die. This is Genesis 3. For God knows when you eat of it, your eyes will be open. You'll be like God, knowing good and evil. So when the woman saw that the tree was good to eat, what happened there? She knew it wasn't good. Had she seen it before? Yes, she'd seen it before. But all of a sudden, a mirage is there before her. She sees the tree differently in that moment. This tree is good to eat. And she acts. We know the sad consequence, but not just of her story, of so many stories. So, Emmanuel, when we read Samson's story, if we want to be people who do life differently than him, to get to a different place than he gets, grow the gap. Build the gap between that impulse and the action. Consider it. Wrestle it through in the gap. Think about what's being offered to you. Think about what God has promised to you. Because he will be glorified when we grow the gap and trust in him instead of the promise of sin.